BP's oil gusher could be a double whammy.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, good morning. I'm Steve Chiatakis. BP today is going to test a cap it successfully put on its spewing oil well in the Gulf of Mexico. Robots secured a stack of valves on top of the broken well yesterday, which the oil giant says should stop the flow temporarily. Work continues on relief wells that are supposed to eventually stop the oil altogether. BP estimates it spent somewhere around $3.5 billion on the spill, and there's still a ton of work to do. Now, the Financial Times reports money being paid for cleanup could very well tap into the amount BP was likely to pay in taxes. The ratings agency Moody's downgraded the credit of Portugal today. That's going to make it harder for the Portuguese government to borrow money. And the value of the euro has dropped on the news. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London to talk about it. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
All right, so Portugal's not a huge economy. How big a deal is this?
Well, yes, you're right. I mean, Portugal is a small economy. It's only two-thirds the size of Greece, which is itself pretty small. But this downgrade is a reminder that the big problem overhanging global markets hasn't gone away. And that, of course, is the problem of government or sovereign debt. The fear that one or more of these heavily indebted Eurozone governments might default, and the fear that that would really rock the euro, the single currency.
And we've been hearing, Stephen, though, that Europe's, you know, turning the corner. I mean, this seems like a surprise.
Yes, I mean, you're right. There has been some calm entering the market. But that talk about the euro turning the corner may have been a little premature, says Neil McKinnon, who watches currency markets for VTB Capital.
There is a real danger of a further slide if we see more problems with European banks and more problems with Eurozone sovereign debt.
And he says traders could get even more jittery about the euro over the next few days because the so-called bank stress tests are coming out here soon. This is something the American banks went through last year, a series of theoretical crises that banks are put through to test their health. Well, the results of the European bank stress tests are due out at the end of next week.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London this morning. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
We got word today the disparity between how much the country imports and exports keeps growing. The nation's trade deficit now tops $42 billion. That's the highest level in a year and a half. Let's check the numbers. Shares in London, Paris, and Frankfurt are up by a percent and a half right now. Asian shares slipped a little today. Wall Street yesterday, small gains for the markets. The Dow added about 18 points to close at 10,216. Global fundraising to help victims of disasters such as earthquakes or tsunamis are common these days, but 25 years ago it was practically unheard of. That is, until two big music concerts, one in Philadelphia, another in London. Live Aid brought together a galaxy of pop stars to raise money for Ethiopian famine relief, and it changed the business of fundraising, as the BBC's Rebecca Singer reports for Marketplace.
In the summer of 1985, over 150,000 people packed into stadiums on both sides of the Atlantic. The pop star turned activist Bob Geldof had mobilised musicians in a new type of fundraising.
It's only the biggest pop event and certainly the most important because of what it's for, and what it's for is the worst natural disaster mankind has ever seen.
The events raised millions of dollars and aid reached poverty-stricken people across Africa. But after Live Aid, organisers realised that money was just a temporary fix and a more sophisticated approach was needed. Peter Gill was one of the first journalists to cover the Ethiopian crisis. He says Live Aid forced American and European governments to pay attention to African poverty.
I don't believe a famine of those proportions is possible.
Since Live Aid, charities have pushed for more permanent assistance, like cancelling the debts of developing countries and the introduction of fairer trade rules. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at Vanguard.com.
Yoga is a growing slice of an already big health market. Classes, mats, books, and other spin-off items have made yoga a $6 billion a year industry. So it's not surprising there's a rush to patent yoga poses at U.S. patent offices. That's got some people in India bent out of shape, as Raymond Thibodeau reports.
In a leafy Delhi suburb, yoga teacher Maini Chaitanya leads a class in Sivananda Yoga. His students crouch down like sprinters at the start of a race, then fold themselves into an upside-down V.
Hold the breath, other leg also, body becomes straight.
Chaitanya says it's hard to imagine that some yoga positions, better known here as asanas, could be off-limits to him and his students because of patent infringements.
Truth can be available to everybody.
Truth is available to everybody. Gravity cannot be patented, same thing. Yoga can't be patented.
But when several yoga gurus in the U.S. started franchising their yoga centers, they applied for patents for their signature styles. V.K. Gupta heads the Traditional Knowledge Digital Library. It's part of India's Center for Scientific and Industrial Research, the government agency trying to stop the patenting of traditional yoga moves. He believes that any patent-hungry yoga teacher doesn't have yoga's best interests at heart.
He wants to make his own money for his own benefit on a knowledge which he has no business to make money because he did not create. That knowledge was created 4,000 years back.
Gupta says the problem is that knowledge is written in Sanskrit, an ancient and little-known Indian language. His team has spent 2 years combing through Sanskrit scriptures to identify at least 900 asanas and catalog them in English and other major languages.
We provide information to the patent system so that they do not grant a wrong patent.
That is, a patent for a yoga pose that already exists. India has agreements with U.S. patent offices to protect its traditional knowledge from being wrongly copyrighted. Still, the U.S. has issued about 130 yoga-related patents to date, many of them apparently for innovations to traditional yoga poses. But with more than 84,000 distinct yoga poses described in India's Sanskrit tomes, coming up with something original could be quite a stretch. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
And finally, author Ernest Hemingway's son is starting a new line of footwear bearing his father's name. Patrick Hemingway says the shoes will be made of quality bison and calf hide. Best part about him, he says, though, you can wear them without socks. He says his dad hated socks. This is the Marketplace Morning Report in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
American Public Media. The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college accountant? How does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox, and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.